friends. The subject of tonight about the war against affluence and love of wealth was somewhat inspired by a tramp who came up to me on the street and asked if I would give him $30.10 for a cup of coffee. I said, why do you want $30.10 for a cup of coffee? He said, you wouldn't want me to go in and buy a cup of coffee in this suit, would you? I can remember when I was a boy, there were four brothers in our family, and this was Sunday night, and some unexpected visitors dropped in. And we were having for dinner that night boiled ham. And Mother gave the orders, FHB, family hold back, because there wasn't enough to go around the 10 visitors. And so we were told, when the boiled ham was served, that we would prefer peanut butter sandwiches. Well, we played the role well, and we didn't mind it either, first of all, because we like them, and secondly, because we knew that there was wonderful apple pie for dessert. So when the others had eaten the boiled ham and we had finished the peanut butter sandwiches, Mother opened the door and she said to the four of us, she said, because you were boys didn't eat any ham, now you can't have any apple pie. Well, what about affluence? We know there's a war against poverty going on, but there's another war. The war against affluence, the excessive love of money. Now, in order that I might give my angel some work to do, I am going to write out on the blackboard just what is, first of all, the nature of affluence and greed and avarice, then the origins of it, and then we will go into the war against all of these factors. What characterizes a greedy or an avaricious man? Three things. A passion for accumulation or getting. Accumulation is better, but I was not sure I knew how to spell it for the moment. So I put down getting. Then, next, there is a reluctance to give. And thirdly, this is a quote, the world owes me a living. Now, this characterization, you see, of excessive love of the dollar and profit and cutting corners to make money applies not only to those that are rich, but also to those that are on relief of a certain type. First of all, a passion for getting. There are some who almost seem to live for no other purpose than just simply to add pile to pile. Without going into any particulars, it might be interesting just to recall what Milton wrote in Paradise Lost about an angel in heaven that my angel said he knew before the fall. The angel in heaven before the fall was called Mammon. And my angel told me that he remembers it very well. He always walked like this. He was looking at the streets of gold. He just loved them. Well, after a while, we get to be like that which we love. You love gold, you get cold and yellow. And hard. So after a while, Mammon fell. And there are other people in this world who are following Mammon. I know one man who found once a $5 bill in the street. And you know, from that time on, He never, never could keep his eyes off gutters. He was always going along like this. And at the end of 30 years, he had accumulated 2,418 hairpins, 742 buttons, and 82 Goldwater stickers. And a stiff neck. Now, there's no point in going into a description of those who pile millions and onto millions. What makes them that way, we will talk about later. But that's the first characteristic of the avaricious. The desire to accumulate. Then second, a reluctance to give. The rich are generally, not always, the rich are generally the poorest tippers. Sure, that's right. Yeah, now we're going to have, this is going to be a dialogue. It's an audience participation show. There is I know of one rich man who, whenever he gives anything, will excuse the small tip, saying, well, I don't want to spoil him. I heard of another rich man who, when his friend gave a big tip, he said, what are you trying to do, pension him for life? You know, Dostoevsky, this is Dostoevsky's brother's Karamazov. Dostoevsky has a beautiful story in here about the refusal to give. And it's about an onion. He calls it an onion. And he tells about a peasant woman who once was very cruel to her neighbors and mean. And when she died, she was buried in the lake of hell. And her guardian angel said, I wonder if there isn't something that I can do to get her out. And somebody told the guardian angel, yes, she once pulled up an onion and gave it to a poor man. And the guardian angel told God, and God said, all right, you take an onion and drop the onion, hold the onion above hell, and tell the old woman to get hold of the onion. And if she holds on to the onion, as you pull it out, we will take her to paradise. And if she doesn't hold on, then she will fall back to hell. So the angel dropped the onion, and the woman got hold of it. And when the other saw that she was being pulled out, they began holding on to her. She turned back to them and she says, don't hold on to me, this is my onion. And she went back again to hell. And that's the way it is with the affluent. It's my money. It's my wealth. And they have so much identified having and being that if they give anything, they feel they've lost something of their personality. Then there's that third group, the world owes me a living. That's the group that are not dependents. Here we're not speaking of those who deservedly are dependents, but rather they are dependees. They are almost aggressive against society. And this dependence on others will pass on from generation to generation. And they are never grateful. Gratitude is something that has to be taught. Taught. It's not an instinct. Now, what makes people so very avaricious? Like one of the richest men in the world, for example, who in his magnificent home has a pay telephone. Yes. Do you put in an outgoing call? You have to buy a slug from him. What makes them that way? These people have never grown out of infancy. Freud has made a very penetrating remark about an infant, that at the beginning an infant can never tell the difference between himself and what is outside of him. He is the world, and the world is his. Then there's always an immediacy between the desire and the satisfaction. There must be no delay. So, baby cries, he's given a bottle, cries, his diapers are changed, mother holds out a finger, he holds out a finger, mother grabs the finger, goo goo, everybody gathers around, and he's the center of the stage. Well, this is fine. Then there comes a moment in training where the parents will say, now, there are other people here. You must be kind to them and good to them. The world is not yours. You must begin to serve. These children grow up to be normal. Others never become normal. The excessively wealthy who pile millions onto millions may be, according to their birth certificate, 50, 60 years old, but their real age is 2 or 3. Everything must be brought to them. And with a decline of morality and faith and a belief in the future world, this world begins to be everything. So there has to be a war sometime against affluence. And it has begun, and it's a very interesting war. It is being waged on 3 fronts. On the front of the wealthy themselves, in the field of religion, in the field of the young and what might be called the new humanists. First of all, the war against affluence is indirectly being waged even by the affluent. And how do the very rich do it? Generally by going into politics. Because money today is not too popular, and the rich know it. So in order to keep wealth, they must have some show of service. Politics is a new power. Money helps. One creates the illusion that one is interested in others, helping others. And it is to be noted psychologically that the politicians who are rich always run up the biggest debts. The politicians who are poor generally do not put a nation into debt. The rich, in order to protect themselves, will spend public money, but they don't go into their own pockets. But at any rate, they're on the defensive. And religion, too. Is on the defensive. Religion feels very uncomfortable if it is too affluent. As a matter of fact, just as the rich will go into politics, so too. Religion and those who are religious lose all of their spiritual influence just as soon as they become materially powerful. And we know very well that there are at least 100 million people in the world would take the vow of poverty tomorrow. They could live as well, sleep as well, be clothed as well, housed as well as those who have the vow of poverty. There are indeed critics of religion on this ground, but they are not to be taken too seriously. Always ask them, how much do they give? And religion has become critical of itself, and today we had at the council, for example, 13 different schemata, decrees, and general plans of discussion. Did you know that a group of bishops in the world have gathered together to do what they call Schema 14. And a number of them have signed it. One, they promise never to live above the level of the people whom they serve. Second, they will not give themselves over to administration of wealth. They will get laymen to do that. Thirdly, they will serve particularly the poor without neglecting others. In the work that I have in serving the poor of the world, believe me, I can tell you there's been a tremendous change as regards religion and wealth in the last few years. And I could inspire you, if I had much time, by telling you all of the sacrifices that religion is making for the sake of the poor of the world. But there's another front. And this is more positive. It is in part the front of youth. Why are there beatniks? Why are there these anti-social groups? Partly, not wholly, but partly a protest against parents, against an adoration of wealth, against our materialism, against the false ethos of our society. And they refuse to fit in it. Young people today, for example, do not want expensive marriages. They're rather apologetic sometimes of the accumulation of wealth on the part of their parents. So there is developing in the world what we might call new humanists. New humanists. They are the young, but also some who are older. And they have begun serving the poor for two reasons. First of all, they're very empty on the inside. Whatever they have, whatever the affluent civilization around them has given them, has not satisfied them. There's a void in their hearts, and they want it filled. That's the first point. Now, it is interesting how they are, how close they are to the first beatitude. Happy are the poor in spirit. Let's go to that beatitude. How can the poor in spirit be happy? Well, there are two words for happiness, I mean for poor, in Greek. One is paines, and the other is patokos. Paines would be, for example, a man who just barely earns enough to keep his body and soul together, as well as his family. He's not able to lay aside any savings. It's just a hand-to-mouth existence. Now, the other word for poor is patokos. This is the man who's got nothing. He's completely dependent upon others. He's in a miserable state of total indigence. Which word is used, blessed are the poor in spirit? This one. Poor in spirit. Now, that's just exactly what this new generation is insisting upon. Namely, they're empty. Nothing around them satisfies. And just as the poor in spirit saying, I am empty and I depended upon the Heavenly Father, so they are saying, I'm empty. I have to do something. I must begin to serve others. And that's their outlet, and that's the second point. They begin to serve. And this makes them very happy. And they see humanity almost as a tree. And the leaves change, but humanity is one. And they want to serve that one humanity. And they so much love that one humanity, they almost see it, for example, like Mozart saw music. Someone asked Mozart if he if he heard them notes as he wrote them down. He said, I hear the whole composition before I write a single note. That's the way they see humanity. And they're impatient to fill this void, and they know the only way to do it is to begin to love their neighbor. They're like something like Francis of Assisi. Remember, his father got hold of him because he'd sold some of the bales of cotton and given them the money to the poor. And St. Francis said, and he was brought to court, threw the bag of gold on the floor, tore off his clothing, every piece except one, and that was a hair shirt, piled them all on top of the gold. He says, up till now I have called you, Pietro Bernardoni, my father. From now on I have no father but God. And he went out walking the frozen ground between the frosty trees. He could see himself just as silly as a fly on a window pane. He could see the word fool written in luminous letters across his path as he walked. He didn't mind that. He would go on being a fool, a court fool to the King of Paradise. And that's what the Peace Corps, missionaries, young workers, social workers in the world today are doing. They feel this emptiness. They're feeling it, and they're going out into the world. They're breaking through this veil of poverty because someone else who was rich broke through before. They do not know it. But they seem to be meeting everywhere a stranger. They meet a babe, for example, who's in straw. That's a stranger to them. A boy who is lost and finds his way maybe into a temple, answering questions and asking questions. That's the stranger they meet. And then they meet those who have nowhere to lay their head. And they know the foxes have holes and the birds of the air their nests. And that's the stranger they meet. And then the junkies, the criminals, the thieves, the prostitutes, all part of this great humanity. That's the stranger they meet. They do not know it in this war of influence who this stranger is. One day, they will know. The stranger will appear. I was hungry, and you gave me to eat.
Bishop Sheen will return in a moment.
If I could leave the studio, you know what I'd like to do? I would like to take one of these carnations or one of these roses and go out to you and give each and every one of you a rose or a carnation just in order to thank you for listening to me. Bye now, and God love you.